Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day. This week, conversations with two poets. We'll hear from Rita Dove in the second half of this program, but first, Joy Harjo. Harjo is a performer and writer of the Muscogee Creek Nation. She's currently serving her second term as United States Poet Laureate. Much of Harjo's poetry incorporates indigenous myths. She also addresses feminism and social justice. Her newest book is a memoir, Poet Warrior. On August 16th, 2021, Harjo talked to Stephen Wynn about her work. Join us now for a conversation with Joy Harjo.
Joy, I wanted to start by saying that one of the fascinations of Poet Warrior and Crazy Brave is the accounting of how it was you came to poetry and how that came about. My sense is that you were first a painter and a musician before you really were a poet, and you actually say things like that I was not the best listener or speaker, and I don't have the best memory, and at one point saying I was not easy with words. You describe yourself as a girl with her head down and her hair in her eyes. So I wonder if you could reflect back on that and how your early artistic impulses, which seemed to be more about drawing and painting, sort of migrated towards poetry, and how that came about.
Yes, it surprised me. I love poetry. I love words. My mother used to write songs, and we had some of the best country swing musicians at our home jamming out. And she wrote lyrics and melodies and so on. And that was really my first, she was my introduction to poetry. She also remembered from her eighth grade education poems by William Blake, you know, the classics, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, you know, Little Lamb. And
right, I was struck by that, yes.
And so she remembered those, and she used, I was thinking how she used those meters too very much in her songwriting. And so I loved music, and I loved words, and I loved poetry. But it wasn't until I was a student at the University of New Mexico and part of Native Rights movements that I even thought about writing poetry. And it came about being around some of the first Native poets and listening and just starting to write, just to write down what I was witnessing. I mean, I guess for me, poetry at first became a kind of witness or testimony to what I was seeing as a young Native woman going down as the, you know, as someone who was, you know, I felt very engaged in the fight or the struggle for Native rights.
So it's really that impulse that sort of led you towards writing poetry more than sort of a literary impulse in a sense. It was more a sense of, it's fair to say, a kind of mission that you felt about it, or?
I don't know that I felt a mission. I was certainly attracted to the craft and the artistry of it, you know, as a means of self-expression. But I was also engaged by the voices. I mean, I thought a lot about how, you know, there are the poems that I read in my textbooks and up through from elementary school all the way into college. And then I thought about the poetry that I was starting to hear that I didn't hear in the textbooks, which were poetry by Native people, early Chicano poets, many, you know, African American poets, some very few in the textbooks. Now and then you would see Langston Hughes. But there was so much I was hearing that I didn't grow up hearing that kind of poetry. So it opened a doorway to hear Native poets, to hear Chicano poets, to hear Asian American poets, African American poets, opened a doorway that said, wow, this is America, and this is, even a diversity of Native nations, you know, that, wow, my voice, there's a place for voices. There are place for voices that are not just Western European or English, or even not just Northeast United States voices.
Yes, I'm thinking you mentioned the Louis Untermeyer collection of verses. There probably weren't many native or for that matter any voices outside the traditional Western canon in that
No, they
collection.
weren't, and I love that. I still love that collection, but and I heard Rita Dove even reference that collection recently. But
Oh,
yeah.
she had it also as a young writer,
Yes,
huh?
she also had that, but
Oh,
I it was a
that's
refuge
interesting.
for me, just that kind of song. I think of it as song language, and it was so evocative. And so it was a beginning, but I also, as I was coming into poetry, I listened to testimonies of traditional native people who were speaking sometimes in their native language, and it was translated or speaking in English as they gave testimony to oil companies or to coal companies or to uranium companies. And the poetry of their voices or entreaties were so in contrast to the legalese and political talk that was going down for theft.
Hearing those voices that you hadn't heard before, that kind of poetry, did it just kind of open you up? Did it happen quickly, or was it more a gradual emergence for you? Did you say, "My goodness, those voices are in me also, and this can unlock them"?
I don't know that it was sudden. I think it was maybe relatively sudden if you think in terms of years and eons, but I don't know that there was a point that I consciously said, wow, this is what's going, this is what's going on. It was kind of a natural movement towards writing. And even as I was became an art major, a studio art major, and was painting and drawing, and I started writing in my notebooks and started writing poetry, and then decided to take a creative writing class. And something took hold there. That surprised me. And later I was able to put together, just what opened for me to allow that. I think I think half of me is very intuitive, and the other half over intellectualizes everything. So that it's poetry for me. Well, I think every art embodies both. But I began writing, and I found an artistry in it, and I also I came to realize that it came to me perhaps as a teacher. We have many teachers in this life, and I think poetry has been one of my most profound teachers and one of the teachers that's been hardest on me. I've even felt at times that poetry abandoned me, but I came to realize that no, I abandoned poetry.
I mean, you touched on that sort of dual sense of being both intellect and intuition. It comes across in the book very well, in both books. But it's also kind of part of being an artist, isn't it? Is there's that generative thing, and then there's that discerning editor who's always doubting and saying, "Wait a minute, am I going over the top here?" Or that constant sort of monitoring your own process in some ways.
Right, there's that. I think it's the world of duality we live in, but yes, there's the part that's absolutely, creativity, whether you're writing poetry, stories, music, there is that part that has to, you cannot pull in your critical mind into that part, or it will destroy it. You have to just let it be, and then you come back in once you have I think of it as the raw materials and really cool stuff that comes to you that you could never have come to on your own. And if you can't, where does it come from? And et cetera, et cetera. And then you have to bring in the other when you're forming a poem or a story or music. And I've told many audiences, I know that you guys think that poets just have an idea like a lightning coming to you, and you're you're struck.
Just sit down and transcribe it or
Right.
something, huh?
And there's that that goes along, but there's a lot of revision. You're building something. You're building something, and sometimes the form is implied by what comes through, and other times not. And it takes revision, and everyone is different, just like every child is different. Every creation teaches you something else.
It's another thing people think, I think, is that once you learn how to write poetry, you can just sort of turn them out. It doesn't work that way, does it?
No, because it's a constant. I mean, that's why it's so engaging. I think that's why creativity is so engaging, is because you're constantly learning, or life, if you're not dead, if you're not a walking dead person who's refusing to learn anything else, is that there's always something else to understand or to know, and it gets deeper and it gets wider and it gets more and more profound as you go along.
Back to music, which has been, another important creative part of your life all along. I wonder about the way music has influenced your poetry and or and maybe the other way as well. I mean, certainly, while your poetry is varied in all sorts of ways, one quality that it certainly comes across often is the kind of momentum and the phrasing and the musical quality of it. I know it's a bit of a cliche to say that about poetry, but it's true about yours in a much more subtle and meaningful way. And I wonder if you've reflected on the way in which music has, impacted and influenced and is present in your poetry.
Sometimes I have to see them together. If I see them apart, it gets to be too much. It gets to be too much. But yes, I think the music was always there. I mean, I think about the incubation of me as a poet and a musician. The music appears to come later. I didn't pick up a saxophone till I was almost 40, even though I did play clarinet a couple of years as a kid. But I didn't really engage, as a musician or musically until I was almost 40. And I think what I lately recently I was reading a poem. I was reading a poem in some performance, and I was thinking, wow, I'm improvising, even though I revised and everything. But in the way that I was using my voice and the rhythms and so on, I can hear. It's the same thing. It's kind of patterning, and that's what we do with whether it's philosophical thought, whether it's mathematical, scientific theory, anything that we do, we're patterning. Any scientific process, the process of making a tree or anything, it's about patterning. And in that patterning is rhythm. And in that rhythm is music, is sound. There's frequency and there's resonance. And to engage that in whatever, in music, I love that about playing music, is that engagement, that engaging with patterning, and not just the patterning. Sometimes it's just for the intellectual excitement of the patterning, but it's also it has to have an emotional, there's an emotional weight to it, or intent on some level.
Yeah, that certainly comes through. You mentioned a few moments ago the word refuge, and there's a line in Poet Warrior about poetry is a refuge for you from the instability and barrage of human disappointment. And I think you were referring to some of the challenges of your family, that your parents went through a difficult divorce, and then your mother remarried a man who was abusive. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about that, sort of switch gears a little bit, talk about the kind of way in which poetry served you as a young woman growing up and facing some of these challenges in your family.
Yes, as a young woman growing up, I didn't really write poetry. I read it, and just like reading books, I was a prodigious, I read a lot. I would go in every week and check out the maximum allowable number of books, and there was my escape route. I would carry my escape route home and read, and music too, getting those old Columbia House record subscription, and those.
Yes, that was a wonderful detail. And you and I are about the same age, so I knew exactly what you meant. Get those big cardboard envelopes coming in the mail, and like, oh my God, open it up in the LP.
Yeah, it was everything, the stories on the liner notes, the images, it was a whole package. And something about all of that gave me a way to orient, orient through chaos. And I also had a diary. I would write in a diary nothing that would be useful for a literary, for to cash for literary anything. I don't even think I have those. I probably destroyed them, or they were stolen, or whatever. Or
They're part of your juvenilia now. They'd probably fetch a price on the internet now. Here's Joy Harjo's early diary.
oh yeah, I don't think there was much in there except, especially after my stepfather found one and made fun of me. So I stopped that for a while. But I love poetry, and it's certainly creating and so on. It was when I was a student at the University of New Mexico, and that's when I started hearing a lot of poets, including Anne Waldman. I got to hear Anne Waldman for the first time. I heard Galway Connell read that bear
That big
poem, and
famous
that to
bear
me,
poem, yeah.
yes, because that's at the heart of it for me. When I write, it's transformation. How can you turn hatred into love? How can you turn chaos? How can you mine chaos to make something beautiful? And how can we turn around this division or divisiveness? How do we find a way as human beings through the mess? I realize now, when I was a student early on at the University of New Mexico, it was probably I started there in 71, is I realized later that I was probably having what's called a breakdown. But I didn't have the luxury to have a breakdown. I had two children. There would have been no one there to care for them. And I held it together, and I look back, I don't know how, except, through poetry. And that's when I started writing, is, and then my art and other people's art, going in, galleries or listening to music, again, gave me handholds through some very dark moments where I thought I would not be around much longer. And I didn't know how it would happen or what was really behind it, except I think what happened is so many, historical, stuff that wasn't even mine, but historical trauma, et cetera, just landed, a kind of perfect storm. And I started writing. We had a great bookstore down the street, the Living Batch. There were a lot of great readings. And I just started writing, and the writing was, in a way, I think of writing almost like call and response. You write something, and then you listen, and then you go back and forth with this, the great mystery that has an incredible sense of humor and is the most, has the most creative ideas and potential. And so I think that's it became a teacher, so that some of my most famous poems came from that, like the fear poem, I release you, I release you. That poem was given to me. It doesn't mean I revised, of course, but the raw material of it was given to me to help me and that help other people. She had some horses. So many poems. Remember, which is now going to be on the outside of that Lucy spacecraft, at least part of it. So yeah, that's cool. There are several poets that are going to have pieces, and they've got, I guess I saw a video the other day where they installed that placard with poem excerpts from, like, Billy Collins, I think Amanda Gorman, and one of my pieces, and some a few other people.
Poetry has a great reach. Now it literally has a great reach going into
Really.
space. You mentioned spirituality, and certainly it's a leading component of your poetry, and but not in any sort of simple or easily reduced or explainable way. But one of the things I was struck by is the importance of geographical locations for you: east, west, north, and south. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about that and how those compass points anchor and inform the way you that you think and you live and that you work as an artist?
Well, I think that humans are essentially ritualistic. We live, or even ceremonial. You know, we live together, every one of us here on the planet. We live in a circle. We live in a globe. We each, the east is sunrise, wherever you go, even if you're in the southern hemisphere. West is where the sun leaves, and there's a reason why a lot of, you know, many cultures, you know, birth, beginnings, east, west, leaving, shift, change, transformation. North, it would be different in the southern hemisphere. You know, north is colder. It has certain representations, and south has other reputations. You know, it's warmer. It's symbolic in many other ways. And so we're always within this kind of a grid, even as we're in a circle and maneuvering. And we all live together. There's full moons. The moon goes through its changes, even the sun and the way the sun, the earth and the sun move. We're in this constant shifting ritual together. And it marks probably every major holiday of any religion, or, you know, they're all around solstice, you know, the solstice or equinox. If you were to look at it, it works that way because that's innate within us.
One of the striking, wonderful things about reading Poet Warrior, and again, your poetry as well, of course, is the way in which seemingly non-Western thought or non-Western conventional thought comes across so naturally and second nature to you. There's a great line. I love this line. When we look at the sky, we are seeing the future because it is so far away. I mean, I'm just not sure that it's a line that might have occurred to a conventionally raised, part of the canon poet. It's just such a what. And the same thing about omens from snakes and owls and those kind of things that are delivered in such a natural way, not heightened, that this is just part of a belief system that is so deeply embedded that it's reported in a very casual way, but in an uninflected way.
I think that's what climate change is teaching us, or will teach us when it's done with us, because it's not done with us yet. It's very disturbing to see play out what the teachers, the elderly native teachers from way, way back who left us years ago, warned us about, said that we would have fire, said that out of this would be, you know, there would be a water, you know, water shortages. And then with that comes food shortages, unless we change our ways. And in that, though, behind that was that because we have forgotten or are not taking care of those relationships we have with the directions, with each other, with the plants, with the, even with fire as an entity, or with the water as a living entity, or the earth as a living entity, or the trees and all of the creatures as living entities. So I know in the literary world, it's called magical realism, but I think it's matter-of-fact realism. You know, it is, you know, the earth is a living being. You know, you can, even science could prove that now. You know, that there are resonances, there is communication, however you want to call it. And to act as if the world is dead and put here as just a place to mine resources and take anything you want goes against universal law. You don't take more than you can use. A lot of it, I think, is not even, it's just common sense. I think that's why it comes across matter of fact. It's common sense if you think about it.
We just wish more people had that kind of common sense. Especially people in power and people in corporations. And
I know you look at the relationship, you know, what's considered, you know, how women and female power is treated in this country and in the world. I'm devastated by what's going on in Afghanistan. I think, okay, what are my tools? And is there anything, Anything I can do to shift that, just like devastating, with the Greenwood massacres here in Tulsa, or with what's happened, what's happening, with the, we had that wonderful landmark decision, in the Supreme Court affirming Muscogee Creek Nation Reservation, and immediately the, there are people in the state who want to destroy that and silence us. And I think, what is there anything? Because ultimately we're one people. Doesn't mean we're all alike, or that, we have to be of one religion to be of one people. No. Common sense. The world, we have all kinds of plants. There's a reason for our diversity. It gives health and design and life.
You're asking about, what it was you could do, and certainly your work speaks powerfully for itself, but you also do have this platform as a poet laureate. And I wonder how you think about that in terms of having a certain, a certain perch from which people respect and listen to you, and how poetry can exist in these these very pressing problems that we're facing in all sorts of way, climate and others.
Well, I think poetry has emerged and proven itself during these times with COVID, especially when people retreated, retreated in the face of possible death just by touching or breathing something. And poetry, how poetry, the usefulness of poetry became very apparent. I mean, it's always been there. And certainly as poet laureate, I mean, poets, we do our work in the dark, why we do our work quietly. So it's kind of funny to be US poet laureate, and yet I sit in here in my room and work and read and play my sax, and yes, and then I go out, although most of my term, I'm in my third term now, is because is or it starts in September, is that most of it has been done virtually. And in this time, I've had two, one, I feel like I serve poetry. I feel like I'm holding the door open for poetry. That I hold the door open and say, here. I say, one, I'm not the only poet. There are many of us, and poetry belongs to everyone. And I'm not the only native poet. So during my term, I've helped bring out, helped edit two native poetry anthologies. Yeah, one that is, historic and moves historically from some of the oldest written poetry to the most, current poetry, to anthology that goes along with a poet laureate project that shows a map of the United States and how we're part of this place.
That's the Living Nations Living Words program. Yes.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about what that is exactly, this map that you're developing?
Yes, that project came about, of course, when I was named US Poet Laureate, everybody wanted to know what my project was, and it's like, how can I tell you? I just named. I didn't come prepared to be
You didn't
US
know you were
Poet
running for
Laureate.
office, did you?
Right. So I have all kinds of ideas. I always have a lot of ideas, but finally we settled on mapping. This is something that would be available digital to everyone. It would be, have access to almost everyone, and that schools, individuals, people could access it. And so I helped pick out a map that showed this country before, with no political designations, no names. You could just see earth and water, and there's something so freeing about that, and so beautiful to imagine this place before. There's no border between Mexico and the US. There's no border between Canada and the US. And to me, even just to have a map like that, that's just freeing. And then poets. I wanted to show that contemporary poets are everywhere in this country, and there are more. We were limited. We couldn't put hundreds of poets. I wanted to then put all the poets in the country, and they're saying, wait a minute, there's capacity problem, because we all know each other. We work with each other. We've known each other. We're a part of a continuum, on a story map. So we have, I think it's 47 native poets. And the cool thing is you can click and see them, hear them read, and talk about place. And that's going to be more and more crucial as we go along, people, environment. I liked what Bob Haas did with his, when he was poet laureate, about watershed. And I came to San Francisco for a few of those events, but he was a model for me in a way about thinking about watershed and place and where we live and how that really is bound up with poetry. I mean, where does poetry, where's the stuff of our words come from?
And people can access this now. They can go online and see this.
Yes, it's online at the Poet Library of Congress site. I think you can just put in Living Nations, Living Words, or just put my name in the site and it'll come up. And there's also a book of the poems with images of the poets available now from Norton called Living Nations, Living Words.
Wonderful, wonderful project. Well, the time has flown by, but before we go, I would love to have you read a poem for us. And we had talked about two different poems. They're both wonderful poems. Would you rather read Granddaughters or would you rather read Running? It's entirely your call.
I'll read Running.
Great.
That's an intense poem, but I will read it.
It really is. And just before you read it, I just want to say to the listeners that it's a poem that really captures so much about your art and your mastery as a poet. It fuses different kinds of thought, different kinds of myth, different kinds of iconography, and does so in a barroom setting, which is so real and so vivid in itself. So, if you would please, Running.
Yes, I used to write some of my earliest poems in a bar. I would sit there on bar with bar napkins and write notes on what I was hearing and seeing. And everybody's looking for a vision. Everybody is.
You certainly aren't the only poet who has taken to the bar room as an inspiration or a place to write
No, at
a
some point you
retreat.
have to leave. At some point it gets the bar, it has a lifespan.
Well, as there's a great line in this poem about being last call, which cuts in various ways.
Yeah, true, true. Running. It's closing time. Violence is my boyfriend of the cross to bear. Hoisted on by the church, he wears it everywhere. There are no female deities in the Trinity. I don't know how I'm going to get out of here, said the flying fish to the tree. Last call. We've had it with history, we who look for vision here in the Indian and poetry bar somewhere to the left of hell. Now I have to find my way when there's a river to cross and no boat to get me there, when there appears to be no home at all. My father gone, chased by the stepfather's gun. Get out of here. I've found my father at the bar, his ghost at least. Some piece of him in this sorry place. The boyfriend's convincing to a crowd. Right now he's the spell of attraction. What tales he tells in the fog of thin hope. I wander this sad world we've made with the enemy's words. The lights quiver, like they do when the power's dwindling to a dangling string. It's time to go home. We are herded like stone cattle, like children for the bombing drill. Out the door, into the dark street of this old Indian town, where there are no Indians anymore. I was afraid of the dark because then I could see everything. The truth with its eyes staring back at me, the mouth of the dark with its shiny moon teeth. No words, just a hiss and a snap. I could hear my heart hurting with my in the dark ears. I thought I could take it. Where is the party? It's been a century since we left home with the American soldiers at our backs. The party had long started up in the parking lot. He flew through the dark, broke my stride with a punch. I went down, then came up. I thought I could take being a girl with her heart in her arms. I carried it for justice, for the rights of all Indians. We all had that cross to bear. Those old ones followed me, the quiet girl with the long dark hair, the daughter of a warrior who wouldn't give up. I wasn't ready yet to fling free the cross. I ran. And I ran to the 2 a.m. streets. It was my way of breaking free. I was anything but history. I was the wind.
It's just magnificent. We could spend another half hour or more just unpacking all the wonders in this poem. I don't want to try to do that, but I do want to ask you about the genesis and the generation of this poem, and if this was one that was gifted upon you, or was this one that went under many revisions, or if you remember how this poem came about.
Yes, it did go through revisions, and it came about, I was working on the book An American Sunrise, which was about kind of dealing with a certain time period, removal and a particular grandfather on one of my creek lines. And then this poem came out of nowhere, and I'm thinking, now what does this have to do? Well, it has everything to do with it. It has everything to do with historical trauma. It has to do with the end of the, you know, where the Trail of Tears dumped us off. There's so much in that, you know, and of course my father and so on, and a grandfather who is Wind Clan, and I mean there's so much buried in that poem.
Indeed there is, and thank you so much for sharing it with us. And Joy, thank you for spending the time with us today. It's been just wonderful talking with you, and I feel we've barely scratched the surface, but that's because there's so much depth in your work and in your life. And thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much, too.
You've been listening to poet and performer Joy Harjo in conversation with Stephen Wynn. This program was recorded on August 16th, 2021. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Juliet Gelfman-Rondazzo is Associate Director of Communications and Digital Media. The post-production director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Director, Stephen Eckert. The recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The founding producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Haas Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who's coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.
Special thanks to Anne Oyama for making our programs possible as we shelter in place at home. Bye.